Okay, this is based on a true story. Send it on. It's based on a true story I heard at a session. It's called Irish Dancing, and it's set in the Kerry in the 1930s. John watched the sparks dance like lovers around the turf and dreamed. His brother Jack carried more turf inside. The dream had been following them both all day on the bog. The bog community was longing for music, and no musician smiles around, but now a tender dream of it. Jack had spoken his dream aloud after months of gentle heart yearning. His delicate dream of music, the wild fiddle music that echoes the harsh majesty of the bog. He heard it once before. Now John had the same dream. He held it loosely in his mind, like a marriage prospect, or of life in a new land. A young man's dreams are always sweet. Music was following them since, the harsh corncrake calls, the shrill tones of harsh women, the guttural utterances of the men, all were music to them amidst the silence of life. They made a plan, these were practical men, and pursued it. John took a job on the road with a shovel he grasped for the right to be a musician, while Jack milked cows. With the dream of music permeating, they worked for months, and then put on their best clothes for the journey to Cork, with cash for a dream of music. In Cork they found a violin maker and bought the second cheapest instrument available. The train journey home was filled with soft excitement. They took out the violin on the train table, admired its curve and enticing silent charm, strummed the strings in excitement. They knew nothing of how to play. That night they were appalled at their audacity. Their ignorance of music was stuck like a stone in their bellies. An embarrassed silence fell between them. And the next day, the birds mocked their inability to play. Until at market one day, Jack heard of a teacher in a town 7 miles away. Would he walk that walk 40 miles in a day for music? Jack and John walked the walk. Once per week they left home early and walked the road 3 hours there and 3 hours back for a two-hour lesson, devouring the teacher's words, one took notes while the other played. The music grew, driven by love and healthy rivalry of brothers. Jack was first to master a jig. Their mother cried with joy. Your father will be proud of you. She never said that she was proud. Their dad was dead, died on the buildings in London. Their mother hoped music would save them from emigration, a reason to remain. I do believe, why do we have a musician in our midst? It was Joe McCarthy, a ruddy farmer, talking. Nothing would gladden the heart more. Are you good enough, boys? Give us a month, said Jack, and they played and played for a month. No one had ever improved so much in a month, their teacher said, and marvelled at their audacity and competence. Between the words and the fire and the music, John had never been so happy. Jack was better, but John enjoyed it more. Their mother boasted to neighbours after Mass on Sunday, where the priest announced dancing. Music was all right, he said, as long as it didn't lead to dance. Father Bill was a young priest, confused order with godliness, chaos with damnation. He wore his vestments heavily, his stiff collar stiffened him, as it was designed to do. It was a fair day on a bright day in May. Mary was making butter, tending to the urn with sweaty sensuousness that she was aware of. She was 19 and bright in the summer light, her hair was black and straight. She was a girl and dreamed of young lovers, her heart was light as the breeze, and shifted from Paddy to Billy to Joe, and where it might land no one foresaw. Her father old Mick had an eye for the land, and this would govern her choice for her hand. Old bulls in their field a comical sight, but Mary knew she couldn't much fight. Her father's wishes would be a command, to whose hand he choose, she'd give her hand. For Ireland can't find any use for her youth, any surplus strength can go to England, or symbolic castration a priest's lesson. These were the choices facing young men, in this body country of surplus men, there's more room for an old hen. So she'd go to the bull with the biggest fields, or live as a servant girl with no rights. Those were the choices facing Mary. No wonder she found life a little scary. That night it was one fiddle and a baron. John started on fiddle, Jack and baron. The assembled dancers started quickly. The men were suffering and a little twisty. As the full moon rose, so did the sap, and Mary's eye was caught by a handsome chap. Mary was drunk and moonlight in love, he was drunk and music and whiskey. John and the fiddle started in zest, and Mary, a stranger, eloped to the bog. They heard the fiddle music in the distance, a hand was placed on Mary's breast, a youthful hand that was full of love, and Mary felt herself full. Here was a manly, manly rose, and this might be her only chance to love with a man under 50. No, she hadn't lost her sense. This was nothing she would need repent. She responded with a loving touch, caressed his hard-working, sensuous foot. The music rose to a fitting climax. The body earth made for an easy bed. The heather a haven for wide-open love. And man and woman were unified, even for a moment dignified. While the stars looked down in earthly love, heaven's gift was a nearby pot's love. And life started in the earth that day. Her willing yielding left no delay. 4 months later, when the scandal broke, Mary's parents hugged Mary close, but the priest gave a charade from the altar, condemned dancing in all its forms. Then off to John and Jack's he went, entered without invitation, and proceeded with his castigation. And where's this devil's box, the fiddle you call it? Now I'm all for music that's gentle and slow. Give me Beethoven or Mozart to soothe my soul. But this devil's music that you play has nothing going for it, I say. And who do you think you are anyway, taking up the fiddle at 25, after the damage you've done I could fry you alive? And to be nothing compared to what's in store for you, each note that you play is heating the stove of the devil's furnace. That's where you're headed. So to give you a chance to aim to heaven's grove, a lesson that suits will I give you. Jack and John stood silent, as white as a sheep. Their mother mortified, sat in a heap. The priest marched over and picked up the fiddle. For a moment Jack thought he was going to play, but John suddenly foresaw his intention, but it was too late. The fiddle was thrown on the floor, the priest's polished shoe was rising up, and the fiddle was snatched in two by a hoof. It lay like a broken heart on the floor. Their mother issued some kind of apology. The priest walked out living the young men's son. And up in heaven an angel's eye, for every violin that's made with love, calls to life the spiritual guide. A year later, Jack emigrated, made short work of his youth on a building site, married late and never had a child. John was left with his mother to mind. After the fiddle, he cried and cried. He was left an old bull in a field unwed, was left with the sickly sounds of the cowshed, to accompany the fire in the evening, a set of music. John returned only to bury Jack, and the memory came flooding back.
Can we now have Tom Jordan?
Oh yeah, thanks. Sorry. I was smoking. I have another long one, I'm sorry. But I'll make it quick as I can. But it tells a story, a true story, about a friend of mine who attempted to give life to a dream. Upon a day near mid-September, my lady said to me, "I think I'll build a dream for all to see, enliven it with my notes on air, enrich it all around. I'll pour my soul onto the stage and swirl it all around. For this would be a mighty feat, and turn their souls in turn. For that small act of love would be its own reward, and 'tis which I owe in truth to my paranormal ward. I opine 'twas only right that such a vision should see the light of day, and certainly we'd bet the heads of clans for that great day. Soon 'twas all in motion, and we swam upon that ocean of difficulties and doubts. Yet with every threatened scuppery, we, or rather she, produced some magically, and the date closed upon us. And we tackled all before us, or rather she, but as much mixed up in it was me. Perhaps I understood a little now what did befall. Perhaps I understand a little now what did befall she, or perhaps we agreed it necessary to slip the gods with vision and sound into a magic box, which she would open for all to see. The action would be carried with no lack of respect, but its execution was soon proven just a little circumspect." 'Tis here that we meet Mr. Green and Mr. Brown. They came upon the scene just while we were fumbling around. And they had the artistry to perform many of the deeds for which we'd been forlorn. Mr. Green was Mr. Music Man, who'd wear his turban or his icon with a palm. Mr. Brown was a less resplendent image of a man, yet like our own fairy queen, he clasped the keys of her dream in his generous hand, and when a host of angels knowledgeable of Eastern spells did conjure with her a chorus to cry for, I almost forgot myself. Nor can I still, what good it does, no one can tell, for who knows. There's no hiding a boner in a dotty, and it forces one a kind of honesty. So I'll not neglect to mention my suspicion and mistrust in these strangers of the sea, but with the passage of time I soon took on an excited acclaim for these wizards of dreams. The day before the great event was busy, I will vouch, and not a day for football, beer, or lying on the couch. The many little things that to be done, and are fast forgotten. And are fast forgotten, but ever brilliant angel of life, an imperfect creature like us all, was leading the run. But I was left this to make 12 feet tall. All night it toiled, and in the end, a dexterous premier knight did help me hang it on the wall. Meanwhile, his vision had been propelled by an improper haste into a blinking canvas roll in order to lay in wait, which she loathed to do, not being addressed in proper courtesy. So the tinctured box in which this heavenly creature was kept began to dance upon the steps where it was left by poor and blameless Mr. Brown, who shocked to see it falling down, could nothing do but gasp in fright as splinters rose and the vision took flight. As for she who had charmed together this affair, they tore a lump out of her hair before sending her back out there to the gazes of a labouring crowd of unbelievers and uncowed. I sat amongst them, and my queen stood agape behind her dancing body on the stage. Yet as the crippled shows when Rattle's plan was strewn around, she deftly plucked at pieces where they could be found, and wove an entirely different pattern. The vague splendor still in essence present, she found was sympathetic to her lonely incandescence. And the mournful yearning of a crescendo worth a thousand years would gladly do to fill a veil of tears, all else being an entirely other matter. All right.
Now we have Colin Scully.
This is called The Origin of Superlative, or a brief parallel history of language and thought. And was the first word, double its meaning. But was the second, halving its worth. If a reaction to the preceding dilemma, this contortion of letters gave the actors their birth. Initially, three actors were considered sufficient to hold and, but, if within their grasp. But what if circumstances were to change and not reassert themselves? R was enlisted to take on the task. Words like, because, maybe, even, gradually cluttered the spatial domain, until one day, in a last-ditch effort to simplify the system, down from the dreamers, superlative came.
Thanks very much. This is called Checking Out. My copper mails to my consciousness like a death notice against the wall, broken by each from the checkout in which I cannot predict the rhythm. Turning corners with trolleys, try not to be thrown off the train track. Would you like cashback with that? Thanks very much and goodbye. In these minutes, I know your husbands and wives better than you know them yourself. Still the intimacy of strangers deep within this carrier bag. I know what they had for breakfast, whether they say their pleases and thank you. With my store security camera eyes, I try to tell the vampires from those who will turn their necks freely to loosen their palms of sand from the trees. I try to tell from their groceries whether they live life low fat or take it with old trimming. Who pays the bills and who packs the bags? The politics of the supermarket still rife. But then again, wasn't it in this place that Allen Ginsberg made his first child, to all of which frightened children who will never get all the candy you want, no matter how loud we bawl, or smile, or lift our grand anchor. My last day on the checkout, I sliced the time up like a pie into easier to swallow mouthfuls, and write up wish lists in my mind only to bowl them into the waste basket. A bar scratches against a conveyor belt, a needle against final to be spun for the very last time. I clock out, walk outside where I can judge time by a clock without hands, shedding my skin of the uniform, my jacket of stitched plastic bags. I follow the list of the busker to find. Little Red Riding Hood telling her own stories, she sings, "Will you remember me?" Breathing in air, free from conditioning, I nod and proclaim that I will. Twirling a silver moon in my fingers, I walk away, turn my iPod on, and skip to a song of my own selection. And next up we have Eugene Crowley.
Passengers, gift of Kripsar, never a day short. With me of ending, countered by countered blessings. The poor James Kelly bore the wood. The Bishop of Delhi and daughter, old friends. The marriage of Aoife, Princess of Leinster, relocated. Shimmy.
Next up we have Christy Parker.
Good evening to Mr. White. Or after the first time I came here, and this is read the second time because we weren't in the meantime. I'm just going to read 2 poems tonight. Observe my indulgence from this collection is called Going 7 of 1, it's the one with the cows outside the cover again. As far as I know, it's the only body book with a cow's ass in it. And it's funny enough, I was just looking at Trudy tonight and I didn't know what I was going to read, but I decided I'd just go with this one for a start. It's a poem probably that I wrote about 30 years ago. And long before the smoking ban came in, but you might say that Micheál Martin got hold of it sometime and inspired him to do his deputy steed in the meantime. It's called The Smoker's Cow, and it's a true story. It's very simple. As you would write when you were a tender age of 5 and a half. I knew a smoker with a cough, and he coughed so hard his face fell off. And just about his bad luck, it bounced beneath the two-ton truck. And when he put his face back on, his nose was blocked, his smile was gone. He dined to where he once had ears, so he cried wax instead of tears. His forehead, too, was out of place, it was at the bottom of his face. And on his jaw, he wore a frown, and his beard grew upside down. He boasted also 2 moustaches, for beneath his nose now blue eyelashes. So he sold his razors and geezer and used instead his sister's tweezers. His gloom increased when he found out that his ears were in his mouth, which meant while talking onto the street, his hair fought lying through his teeth. He suffered more as time went by, imagining gum bile in the eye. And there was worse than that, I fear. He even went blind in one ear. Now was it easy, I suppose, when he went to pick his nose? I put his small finger in the little holes beneath his chin. His friends were so unsympathetic, especially when he'd have a headache. They'd point the finger and go, "Oh, that's no fucking headache, that's lockjaw." Eventually he cried, "Enough, a face like mine makes life too tough." He shouted twice, "Goodbye, goodbye," and slit his throat from eye to eye. There's a lesson in this tale for you, if you are a smoker too. Protect yourself from such distress. I did notice when I was sitting there tonight that, and we're increasingly during the days that they go by, that one of the most vilest, berated, hated, despised people on this planet of ours, or on this island of ours right now, not the bankers, the developers. And they're getting a hell of a slamming at both times too, as far as I'm concerned. Back in, I come from York, and through the 80s we saw, and through the 90s, so the 80s and the 90s, we saw the town disappearing on us under shadows from fucking high-rise things going up here, there and everywhere. If you ever go around by Goggins Corner in York, you can't see the sea anymore. And if you lived across from Goggins Corner in York, I've been in the houses across there, people lost the light coming to their rooms, the heating bills went up, and nobody gave a fuck because they were going to lose any money. And now they, as you can see, the kids are coming home to ruin. So I wrote it at time of the boom, so it's not a contemporary, but it was prophetic perhaps. And a strong language in this poem, so if you're a tender of this position, and leave now, because my staff will be too late to carry me down the street. Because as I was tending my window box, the man pulled up in his car, parked across two yellow lines, got out and lit a cigar. And as he walked to where I stood, I sized up his profile. I could see this man at present, but I saw no sign of style. His teeth were slightly yellow, his eyes were slightly red, and tufts of hair sprang from his nose and under on his head. His ashen face looked like it had been fashioned out of paste, and the buttons of his cotton shirt fought a battle with his waist. It's a mighty day, I heard him say, and I hope your health is blessed. But once you have the health, I heard him say, don't worry about the rest. With a healthy life and a loving wife and a roof over his head, shall a man's last desire that he can expire in the comfort of his bed. And every word I heard him speak, so he desired from a can. An excessive insincerity emanated from this man. I'm a self-made man myself, he groaned. There were a few fires on the go. I should have plenty of cash in my fiat with this Kelpie tiger, you know. And so he spoke with puffing smoke about getting off one's ass and the openings in the marketplace that no man should let pass. Good window boxes, he next observed. Not very hard to find. I cut the fucking crap, I said, and say what's on your mind. Then he handed me his guitar, and the message that it told said, Will Rabbit, developer, all properties, bought and sold. Would you do with these, said to me, to sell those window boxes? I sent it to the good old spot to put up apartment blocks. I know it takes some clearing, it's a little small, but then again, since the last piece left of open space in the hallway. But I remember in my youth the amazing days I'd spent when grass patch paved my journeys when I was on cement, when I could see the river and the sky of grey or blue without some of the high-rise flats obscuring nature's view, when the roar of commerce didn't drown the sound of children's glee before the abysmal atrocities when my friends and I roamed free. Years before the cockatiels came galloping into town with the JCBs and money schemes to tear our vistas down. But I told this man I didn't mind if his great plan went ahead, as long as he put something back that was just as good instead. But he prattled about releasing and how fortunes would be made. So I told him what I thought of him and his commercial escapade. Yes, you scumbag, you cat piece of shit, you slime-eyed, you slutter, you dead man bastard, you meaty dog crawler, you elephant snapper, you dying of dunking on Jeremy, you rock, I warned you. You tiny gun, stick up your beard as though bliss on your head like the volume, this makes your sister, you tear bomb, you squeeze in the ass of a cow, you scatter from the air on the back of a sow, you shite pot, you bad pot, you doze a BD, you boil on the bottom of a bad SPD. You smell of hot feet and the piss of war, and I press it to show by your pants of your hole. He listened in silence, then neatly he said, well, I suppose, in that case, you don't want to tell me. But if I was to offer you a slimy ass gumshite, you hot-nosed deed, you slumped in a breakfast and a sheep that just peed, you maggot that scrummed in a sewer on the ground and a wind cut off his back and be found, you drift in the prick of a drowned old man, and you choke on the air with the fraps of your nan, you bucket of blue dry, the stink of the sun, with a clap-clap your love like one till you're 61. Can you get the message I try to make clear, take your plans and your scabs and get the fuck out of here? Something personally. All right, so I said, but your last not mine, if the window box values go into decline. I doubt that, I said, because the beauty of plants, they grow without tax breaks or fucking grants. And what foreground grow in such a rude height, and my friends and my neighbors don't know they from night, but he returned to his car, he got in, slammed the door, turned the key, glanced at me, put his foot to the floor, and then he was gone, and I fumed for a while, in the breeze, I caught a tulip, and I swear, I don't mind. Thanks.
Despite the uniform attractive, a block of colour, brown, sitting to rose, I think the only recognizable feature when a teacher bustled down the aisle with a head jump, someone didn't think of it, I imagined I would have to dive in this time. Shed the armband. I couldn't handle it. There was always someone missing. A stick yelled one of the boys with a voice. He led the stigmates off one of the girls, one of the proper girls inside, addressing the shade of her hair in the window, flying with the limitations of a strict and elastic band. The song would start with a crisp. Packets punched open, voices united as the wheels of the bus go round and round, round and round. I listened to the crunch of gravel outside the school. Afterwards, we worked the better. Verbal left and homework passed. We settled into the headrest. Homework, a third horizon. Track boots chlorine dampened in places. Hair congealed. The awkward curls and clumps. Towels sagging on that. Voices half hardened and practically exhausted. The wheels of the bus go round and round and round.
Coppers are thrown in your subway cup, if only it sounded like a million hands tapping all at once. But now each coin that smashes upon another will all build up. It will seem like the suffocation of the air of dignity. To some, reason and awareness will vanish like lost crew members over the Bermuda Triangle of alcoholics, oblivion and denial. high class or low, the epidemic doesn't change size, doesn't choose size. Like hungry dehydration mouths, it feeds off the waves that crash on every coast. Livers the size of deprived countries evolving out of the world, obvious to the earth, but problems are never solved. The sun penetrates the magnifying glass, inverted in his eyes, beams of self-truth invade his mind. But logic is not attractive when there is a long way to go. Hell is murky, and so is reality. Excuses, excuses. So the light retreats, and he is lulled once more by the liquid that he thinks he needs. Like expressive art that can only be seen for a moment, the concrete structures are the canvas and the glass paint is thrown against it. They come across from it, riding in a bottle that quickly smashes. It bursts into a million different pieces like solid waves vibrating and bouncing off this wall that a man cannot break. The rough comes in time and the long distance days, and his sweat weeps out acid where he eventually disintegrates. Pavement, wall, pavement, wall, pavement, wall. There's still a blur of strangers on a quiet afternoon. Thank you, miss, and God bless, he says, while completely consumed by the habit and attaching the truth. This is a personal poem called The Third Time. The watchwoman is on her feet, one arm carrying a weight through the suburbs of what she sees as normality every night. There is no thunder in the sound of her soul. There is no rushing in the sound of her stroll. When the time of street light is night, she echoes the sound of a cricket, implied but out of sight and not there to fright. There I am, as the colourful mobile bars are gently pulled, the eyelids of darkness are pressed open, and my pupils retreat at the many glaring gazes of penetrating glow. I have watched that glow. I have seen it through the weight attached to my long lashes. Then that colour of heat appears, and I have tried to catch it without being burnt. Take this, the washerman said, and with that ingredient, I could survive again. She turned and said to me, don't end up like me. Like what? Her mouth hardly opened. She was afraid to catch the fumes. Used piano hands playing violently against the eardrum, trying to get the invisible crowd of sound to contort and defend. She argued with herself and then with me. Do not see them the way I used to see them. Her palm was branded. Forceful strokes of fingernails shredded her surface like a rough texture vigorously rubbing down her erectile skin. She contacted me. And missing your crazy is not sure because that is the impossible. Do not envy them because they may be the virtuosos of carrying relative secrets. So you must seek to destroy. To be completely liberated from this, you must. Her people stood in line with the pressure of the day.
Thank you very much, Michelle. That was great. Next up, we have Brian Murphy.
And this is for someone who couldn't be here tonight, in the symptoms. Quando apprise la vie, ma vie, la vie des autres, et la vie qui nous ont frappé, comme des arbres, des fleurs, des animaux, des oiseaux. Merci.
Next up we have Barbara Flood. Hello. I just like to say before I read it, I self-published the book and I'm having a launch for it Saturday week, the 7th of March at about 7 o'clock in the evening, and you're all very welcome to see our poems that you're coming on.
Oh,
the few families in Salty and Fun. Yeah, you know, I'm quite nice. But off the road. Some of the best times were off the road. Parked up, settled into a ditch, nested by the uneven hedgerows, flickers with insects and leaves and all kinds of things I won't know the name of. Some of the best times are off the road, parked up, settled into suburbia, nestled by the uneven houses which flicker with people's passion and all kinds of things I don't know the name of. They value more and more the stillness which guides me to rest, free of the pounding tire, searching headlights. Some of the best times are off the road.
Right, we've had a lot of economic poetry tonight, so this is called This Is Not About the Economy. Since when am I a recession? Since when does the Isaac Index measure happiness? A 2-point drop leads to lethargic feelings in the pit of my stomach. I never paid a stockbroker to puppeteer my war. Leave me alone, I'm sick of this shit. I've got bigger problems than the devaluation of the yen. Tomorrow might be cloudy, and I've been having murderous feelings towards the neighbor's dog. Nobody would care if Chico went missing, I knew. The bitch keeps the streets awake. I'd get a pat on the back, surely. My cash would become worthless in the local shop. I don't think that way, Stephen, don't think that way, that's how it starts. It begins with dogs and it ends with courts. I'll be a Sky News splash. Another murderous rampage has been blamed on protectionist US fiscal policy. No, I'm not letting it get to that point. I'm not letting the recession, which by the way I think doesn't exist at all. It is my view, which I'm generous enough to share with you, that we're all existing inside a poorly written novel. The story began, for my generation at least, in the turbulent 80s, with Berlin's wall of falling and a new world order of forming. Days in which you can't be blamed for thinking Irish men spent growing their hair and praying for Henry IV to come back to our land. And perhaps there was some trouble in the north. But I digress. The story started on a rocky road, but lo and behold, the 90s came and St. Haughey proclaimed from on high low tax rates for our American business friends, and with that proclamation, the day was saved. Along came days of Burpee and Boom, and we learned that it was taboo to order cappuccino in the afternoon. All was green as dollars on the Emerald Isle, but the writer had a twist in his sights. The baddie came in the form of the banker. And he threw the Celtic Cubs out of their castles in Carrigaline, and he repossessed the boy racer Subaru. But here we come to today, but do not forget, the writer of our novel is poor, and thus a happy ending is to be expected.
It's a university story, because that's where I work, but it doesn't involve me, it's just entirely fictitious. So there was a knock on the door. There was a knock on the door and a bunch of students barged in, fairly scruffy and ragamuffin as would be expected, but some determination in their stride, injustice knitting their brows and lips tight with purpose. We wish to lodge a complaint, said their leader. He might have been a nice guy and might yet become a politician. And what is it about this time, asked the weary professor. Is it this lecturer guy who insults your non-political non-opinions? Somebody said something that is not relevant to the exams. You have to buy a book? A bad grade incommensurate with your own opinion of yourself? I'm all ears. They had heard this before, of course, but didn't care. It's a lot more serious than that. Well, I'm delighted to hear that you student types are getting serious. Are you about to oppose tyranny and imperial aggression, agitate for an end to a third world debt, maybe even a little demonstration for the US Embassy that might endanger your summer work visas? A letter to the paper, perhaps? I fully realise, said a spokesman, that you single-handedly ended the war in Vietnam and that you put the fear of God into the authorities and with your powerful rhetoric, and that the CIA had put a contract out on you before you went to find yourself in Kathmandu. But I'm afraid that this has to do with The real reason we are here in this university as students are exams. The professor looked at him, a gutsy guy with balls, somebody who would stand on his own two hind legs. "It's all right for you lot," he said, trying to escape the riposte that would hit home. "You've only to write the exams. I have to read the fucking stuff." He thought for a moment that they had backed off. He'd always known that a flash of a red biro frightened even the toughest students. "It's like this," said the student, as collectively as he had been from the start. "There's a thief in the class. He steals our lecture notes, our folders, our files. He may even steal our books. We fear he will pass his exams and get his degree under false pretenses. We think he should be disciplined or even expelled." The professor sat back in his chair, fully satisfied that this was what a professorial chair was for. A grin spread about his jowls. He snapped the red wire on his teeth and chewed to his satisfaction. "Pshaw!" he spat across at them. It was a word he had always wanted to use, but never had an opportunity to know. "You lot, bursting here, telling me that another student is stealing your notes and folders, and so on and so on, and you urge me to dump him in some way? Can you be serious? You lot who steal all you know every day? From Baudrillard and Chomsky and Gramsci and Lacan and Jung and Marx and me and Barthes and Eco and Tagliatelle and Kristeva and Chiorin and Steiner and Berlin and Hamburger and Freud and Ryle and Dworkin and Klein and Luce and Trivian and Bultmann and Verga and Broccoli and Worf and Truffaut and Welch and Wanker and Tabitha and Foucault and Foucault and Keynes and Tarney and Kuybert and Hayek and Chaikin and Buber and Bisson and Beavis and Butters and Benjamin, and you have the neck to come in here to ask me to chuck some out for some fucking student who did you after you? Get some proportion, get a life."